I'm Oma Duval. This morning a peddler through these emerald mountains, and tonight a helpless beggar, first disgraced and then plundered by a sorry band of black-hearted strangers who, out of the kindness of my Christian soul, I took on board and tried to help with their magazine selling while I did mine. His eyes scanned the messy countertops. Household utensils, he cried, seizing a wire whisk clotted with butterscotch pudding, egg beaters and spatulas and can openers and these, he smiled, reverently touching a slotted spoon. These humble kitchen tools, these nuts and bolts of the family, of the heart, in a manner of speaking. And as he spoke, it had come to him, as it did now and would later with the day's first light sifting through the rotting roof, that here he might finally be safe. The older boy might be a problem. He had come from his bedroom into the kitchen, and when he saw his dinner eaten and in his place at the table, at the head of the table opposite his mother, a stranger, a male stranger, his lip had curled and instinctively his fists had clenched.
What the?
Norm, this is Mr. Duval, Marie said, her cheeks bright.
Oma,
Duval corrected, extending his hand. But the boy turned to his mother, demanding to know what was left for him to eat.
Cereal, she said. Or some toast,
she added absently, looking back to Duval.
Where are you from?
She asked.
From everywhere, he said. But lately,
and he spoke sadly, for it had become the truth,
from nowhere.
The fragrance of lilacs filled the kitchen. Benji stared at the cornflakes box as he chewed.
Good morning, sunshine,
the radio announcer called, and Benji winced. He dreaded going to school today and facing the boys who'd seen his father hit him yesterday.
It's now 8:05 in the valley. Outside our studio on State Street, the temperature is 60 degrees and rising by the minute. It looks like the coldest, wettest spring on record is finally over, thanks to the high pressure that's moving rapidly up from the south. It looks like summer's finally on her way.
The little house began to tremble with vibrating pipes and an outburst of cranky voices. Norm had to get into the bathroom to brush his teeth, but Alice was still in there. His mother hollered from the top of the stairs for Alice to give Norm his toothbrush. She slid it under the door.
Now there's crud all over my toothbrush,
Norm complained.
Better than crud all over your teeth,
Alice yelled from the bathroom. The telephone was ringing.
I got it,
Norm hollered.
If it's your father, I'm not here,
Marie yelled down. Benji's eyes never left the box as he chewed. He hadn't told his mother about meeting his father. He never told her bad things. The news was on the radio.
Woodstock police warn that a group of door-to-door con artists were last seen.
The radio sputtered with static. Behind Benji, the washing machine gurgled as it changed cycles. Now it began to suck and pump out its wash water. The floor vibrated, and the lilacs trembled on the table, and the cereal box teetered back and forth, so that Benji had to hold on to it as he ate. The shaking stopped as the machine began to fill with water.
Benji, pour the bleach in,
his mother yelled on her way downstairs. He got up and added the bleach, then slammed the lid down when he saw his sister's blood-stained underpants. He sat back down and blinked at the cornflakes box, waiting for his mother's attack.
And this just in,
the radio announcer said excitedly.
Last night, the newly planted grass in the town park was torn to shreds by a pack of unidentified hoodlums who drove their cars and motorcycles up and down the paths. Department of Public Works head Alderman Jardin Green assures us that most of the damage will be repaired in time for the season's first band concert. Green also says that as bandmaster, he will not tolerate any of the hooliganism that spoiled last year's.
From the other room came a tattoo of hollow thumps as his mother banged on the bathroom door.
What the hell are you doing in there?
She demanded.
I can't be late again.
At the sound of her footsteps, Benji closed his eyes, but she ran back upstairs.
Out of respect for one of its oldest members, tonight's town council meeting has been postponed. Funeral services for Judge Clay.
Benji looked up as Norm ran into the kitchen with his toothbrush clenched between his teeth.
Guess what?
He grinned, tucking his shirt into his pants.
Craig's got a busted ankle. Last night, a bunch of seniors went drinking up to the flats, and they started pegging rocks off the pigman's roof, and then he started chasing them, and Craig fell in the brook, and crack! Norm chuckled. No catcher for tomorrow's game, but me. Tell me there's no God? Norm laughed. He flipped his tie over his shoulder, then took the toothpaste from his pocket and started to brush his teeth over the kitchen sink. Behind the cornflakes box, Benji sighed, relieved that it hadn't been his father calling. Tell me there's no such thing as fate. Norm glanced back with a foaming smile. For every calamity, there's a great man. For the Civil War, there was Lincoln. After each declaration, he spat into the sink, then brushed furiously. For the Depression, there was FDR. And now, for the Atkinson-St. Mary's game, there is Norman Fermoyle. He looked back. Weeb said they got no choice. They gotta play me. He held his tie to his chest and bent to drink from the faucet. Damn ants, he muttered, splashing them down the drain. I was at Weeb's house one time, and Mrs. Miller saw an ant on the windowsill. One little ant, and she went nuts. Meanwhile, this dump's headquarters for every ant in the state. At this, Benji's tension erupted in a burst of laughter. Norm looked at him. Geez, you're just like Weeb. You'll laugh at anything. Swallowing hard, Benji blinked himself into somberness. Norm sat down and drummed his fingertips on the table. The washing machine gently swished and splashed. From the radio, Johnny Mathis was singing The Twelfth of Never. A faraway look came over Norm's face. The minute I woke up, I knew something was going to happen today. Something special, something... He looked at Benji. Something that'd make a real difference, you know what I mean? You know how sometimes you just know? I mean, nobody's got to tell you. The minute the phone rang, I knew it was going to be Weave. And before he even said it, I knew he was going to tell me I'd be playing tomorrow. Norm sighed and shook his head in amazement. But how does Weeb know for sure? Benji asked. Because of a fight in the first game, Coach Graber hadn't let Norm in a game all season. Where have you been? Norm groaned in disgust. He's the manager. He stood up and opened the back door. Of course, if you'd play a little ball yourself instead of hiding in the house watching TV all the time. Hey, where the hell's my glove? He pointed up at the empty nail in the back hall. I put it right there. Benji shrugged. Maybe you left it at practice. Norm's eyes narrowed on him. You didn't take it, did you? No, Benji said. The rinse water drained out of the machine with a sucking groan. Paul Anka was singing Lonely Boy. You did, didn't you? You little thief! Norm pounded the table. You took my glove! No, honest, Norm! From the other room, a door slammed, and then came his sister's shrill cry as she ran upstairs in her robe. I don't see why we can't have a shower like normal people! Because we're not normal people, their mother shouted from the bathroom. Upstairs, another door slammed. Norm leaned over the table. I can tell you're lying. You took it. Jesus Christ, Benji, he pleaded. I gotta go. Tell me where it is. I didn't take it. Now Norm's square jaw quivered, and his handsome face twisted as he sprang at Benji, and grabbing him by the collar, yanked him half out of the chair. Today's my big chance, he panted. I gotta have my glove. I don't know where it is, Benji insisted. Honest, Norm. The washing machine clanged to a stop. Paul Anka's voice wailed into the sudden silence. Outside, Klubach's dog began to bark. Please, Benji, Norm begged. You don't know what this means to me. Maybe that guy last night took it, he said, remembering Duval's hungry eyes coveting every object in the room. What guy? Norm asked. The one in the garage. What do you mean? Norm went to the back door and looked out at the garage. I thought she took him to the depot. She did. And then she took him back here. Why? Norm asked, and Benji shrugged. You mean he's out there, that creep's out in the garage? Norm said in a high voice. Now the machine began to spin, its insides grinding, turning faster and faster and faster, with the deafening, grating screech of metal on metal. His mother raced into the kitchen in her slip. At the corner of her mouth was a jagged red smear where the lipstick had jerked when the machine went berserk. Damn that, Renee, she cried, trying to push in the dial that would turn off the washer, but it wouldn't budge. The machine continued its spin cycle with such force now that it shimmied out from the wall toward the table. Bastard, she groaned, pushing every button. With an angry clang, the machine lurched and rocked out even more. There was no stopping it. She began to beat it. She pounded the quaking lid with her fists. Her hair hung in her face. Feet braced, back arched, she put both hands on the machine, trying to wrest it back. It was all Renee's fault, she groaned, her ex-brother-in-law, who had sold her this piece of shit secondhand because she couldn't afford new. Never could. Nothing but junk that never worked, and a car that was on its last legs, and bills! Nothing but goddamn bills, and nobody cares! Nobody in the whole goddamn world cares! Alice came to the doorway, pulling curlers from her hair. Norm yelled at his mother to stop it. With the machine still advancing, Benji slid out of its way, out of everyone's way, to put his bowl in the sink, where a clot of ants massed over the gravy on last night's supper plates. He lifted the curtain from the window over the sink and saw Mr. Klubach in his white butcher's coveralls pause on his back steps and glance warily across at the Vermoil house. Down in the driveway sat Klubach's dog, its head cocked curiously up at Benji.
"Get out of the way!"
Norm bellowed, then reached behind the machine and yanked the cord from the outlet. Benji turned off the radio, and for a moment the only sound was Mr. Klubach's car cruising down the street.
"What's the matter with you?" Norm cried. "Are you crazy?"
His mother sagged against the refrigerator, with her face in her hands, her shoulders heaving. Norm threw down the cord.
"That's all you had to do, that's all!"
At this, her head whipped up.
"That's all? That's all, huh?"
She laughed a bitter, teary laugh.
"You think it's so easy. You think everything's so damn easy."
Benji looked away from his brother's familiar sneer.
"Are you kidding?"
Norm laughed.
"In this nut house, with some bum sleeping in the garage, how the hell could anything be easy here?"
Her eyes flashed.
"Nut house? Is that what it is?"
Pointing, she came toward Norm, teeth clenched. He stared down at her hand jabbing his chest.
"Then get the hell out if it's such a nut house. Go live with your father. See how you like it in that nut house with your goddamn vicious aunt."
"Mom!"
Alice kept saying.
"Mom!"
Sometimes Norm and their mother almost seemed to enjoy these battles, as if vying to see who could be sharper, more clever, more cruel.
"And her creep of a husband, and your crazy senile grandmother singing nursery rhymes all night long in her crib, and your no-good spineless drunken father not giving a damn if his own kids live or die,"
she hissed, with one last strike at Norm's chest. He took her hand away and dropped it.
"I'll get out," he said, "gladly. But first you tell that little creep I want my glove."
She spun around to Benji.
"I don't have his glove,"
he said. She laughed, but there were tears in her eyes.
"A dollar a week I'm paying for that glove. A dollar a week Mr. Briscoe takes out of my measly paycheck. And you lost it,"
she sobbed, shaking her head at Norm.
"You're so damn careless. Nothing means anything to you, does it? All you care about is you. It's up there,"
Alice cried, pointing to the top of the refrigerator.
"Where you put it, Norm?"
Norm started to say something. Instead, he grabbed his glove and books and ran down the driveway. Marie Vermoil's jaw trembled, then set like a closing fist. From next door, Jesse Klubach's voice pealed like a glass bell through the warm spring morning.
"Louis! Louis! You forgot to kiss Mommy goodbye!"
Coach Graber's whistle blew. Practice was over, and Norm's heart leaped. It was official. Tomorrow, he would catch in the biggest game of the year.
"Wait up,"
Weeb called. He was picking up the bases. Usually Norm helped, but today he followed his teammates off the field. He was the only sophomore on varsity. Weeb had been cut the first day, but he kept on showing up at all the tryouts and then the practices, so Coach Graber let him run for water and shag balls, and then he made him assistant manager. In Norm's first game, he had struck out with such force in his last swing that the bat had flown down the baseline as he spiraled into a foolish heap over the plate. "Asshole," someone had muttered, and the next thing Norm knew,
Graber was peeling him off the moaning, bloody-nosed catcher by the seat of his pants. Ever since, Graber had hated his guts. He told everyone Norm was a hothead, a poor sport, a disgrace as a Catholic, and a lousy catcher. But that was all right. The rest of the guys liked him. And more important, they respected him. They never gave him the shit jobs like they did poor Weeb, he thought as he trailed the older players back to the locker room, his gait the same rolling heel-to-toe strut as theirs, his shirt tail out, his cap low to his eyes and mean, his square younger face aglow in the lowering sun and the warmth of their camaraderie. And now, as they trooped into the dark locker room, he shivered with pleasure in the musky commingling of their hard-earned sweat and their rude talk as they lingered over the long, gouged benches. Weeb rushed in and stacked the bases in the corner. Always out of breath and erratic with energy, he ran up to Norm and squealed,
"Jesus Christ, Norm, you did every fucking thing fucking perfect!"
He pummeled Norm's arm with a flurry of harmless jabs.
"Hey, Miller!"
Billy Hendricks, the tall senior first baseman, came in and called out to Weeb.
"Graber says you forgot the fucking first aid kit."
"Shit,
shit,"
Weeb muttered as he ran off. Norm looked around at his teammates' grimy faces, limned with sweat and their sun-reddened eyes, and a jolt went through him. Suddenly he understood why wars were fought, and how it was with buddies willing to heave themselves onto bouncing hand grenades. In here it was Audie Murphy and John Wayne and Newt Rockne. In here was the most he'd ever seen of truth and goodness and fair play. In here, boys were men, and the Gipper was all there was of sorrow and courage, and nobody gave a fuck if his father'd been drunk for the last 2 weeks and out of work for years. In here, there was only unity and heroes, and the weak were never trampled, but goaded gently to strength. Weeb ran back inside with the first aid kit and the canvas bat bag, which he dumped under the stairs. Talking all the way, he followed Norm to the toilet stalls, entering the one beside him.
"Great practice, Norm. You're really firing the ball to second. You must have blocked 5 pitches in the dirt. Jesus Christ, Norm, I never saw you do so good. I mean it."
In the privacy of the stall, Norm shook his head and grinned at the machine gun rattle of the sudden laughter from the shower room. Laughter he had practiced so often that now it was his laugh, too. Billy Hendricks's voice rose over the laughter.
"Hey, Brady!"
Hendricks hollered, and then snapped his towel.
"Cut it out!"
Brady yelped. Norm smiled, knowing that Brady's ass had just been stung by Billy's wet towel. The towel snapped again.
"You fucker, Hendricks!"
Bobby Busco bellowed. In the next stall, Weeb's foot arched. Last week, when Hendricks snapped his towel at Weeb, he had burst into tears with the pain.
"Hey, Busco!"
Hendricks shouted.
"Tell him about Fermoyle's old man hitting his little brother." "Oh, yeah, I couldn't believe it,"
Busco yelled back.
"The guy was so drunk."
"Shut up,"
Brady hollered.
"Norm's..."
"He's gone,"
Hendricks shouted.
"And even if he wasn't, he's such an asshole. Tell him." "I never saw anybody so far gone,"
Busco shouted for everyone to hear.
"The guy can barely stand up. And then Fermoyle's kid brother comes along, and he's smacking him, and the kid's crying, and then he takes off. So then we go over, and we start shoving the asshole and saying, 'How come you did that?'"
Norm bit the inside of his cheek until it bled, and then he flushed the toilet and held the handle down so Weeb wouldn't hear him gag. As the last of the water swirled down the slimy bowl, he opened the door, and he heard Weeb call weakly, "Don't, Norm." He wanted Busco. But all he could see through the steam was Billy Hendricks's dripping wet face and the meaty splat of his lips under his fist. But then Hendricks fell, and for a minute he couldn't find him in the sudden writhing, steamy contortion of hairy legs and shriveled peckers. But now he had found him, was on him again, this time with both fists. Couldn't breathe. Someone was choking him, pulling him by the throat over the slimy floor. It was Graber. Coach Graber, dragging him, then dumping him against the bench where Weeb stood now, whimpering as he dabbed at his face with a towel, then jumped back with a gasp when Graber returned screaming, screaming at Norm like a woman. He grabbed his shirt, yanked him to his feet, then shoved him through the door on his hands and knees out into the dust.
Graber opened the door once more to let a stricken-faced weeb out to his friend. The door opened again, and he threw out Norm's glove. As the door closed, Weeb hollered, "It wasn't Norm's fault!" The door opened again, and Graber's mouth opened. But before he could say a word, Norm had picked up his beloved glove and flung it square and hard in the coach's ashen face. Graber picked up the glove and ran to the railing and whipped it at Norm's feet.
"You're done! You're dead! You hear me?"
Graber's voice trembled down. Norm kicked aside the glove.
"Fuck you, Graber," he roared,
as Weeb grabbed the glove and tried to hustle him away. He was in the backyard, hanging the dripping wash on the sagging clothesline. His mother had called from work with a list of chores to do before she got home. This was his last task. Now, as he stuck clothespins on the corners of the towel, he glanced toward the large wooden box where Louis and his dog crouched so Mrs. Klubach wouldn't see them over here. Louis was telling him about a second-grade girl who'd wet her pants in school today. This was a great fear of Louis's. He was always talking about someone who'd wet their pants in front of everyone.
"Where's that guy?" Louis asked. "The one yesterday."
He looked toward the garage.
"I don't know," Benji said. "Took off, I guess." "My mother saw him go in your house. She said nobody goes in your house," Louis said. "Sure they do. Lots of people do."
"I never do," Louis said.
"You're too young."
Benji reached into the basket for Norm's undershirt.
"How old do I have to be?"
Louis asked.
10.
"I can go in when I'm 10?
Louis looked pleased.
"Yep,"
Benji said. He had run out of clothespins. He looked on the ground for some. Whatever fell in this yard stayed there. Next to the wooden box that the washing machine had come in 3 years ago was a bent aluminum lawn chair, its torn webbing shredded and embedded in the tall grass. A thin, waxy slip of poison ivy was entwined around one of its legs. Along the dark eastern side of the house, where once there had been a split-rail fence, now two bleached posts were all that stood. The rest, poles and rails, were rotting somewhere beneath the bramble of honeysuckle and wild juniper of the advancing woods, from which had already crept, dark and unnoticed, a fibrous vine, thick as a rope, up the rusted drain spout, then up along the roof, its hairy tentacles rooted in the curled, brittle shingles that flashed the crooked chimney. Next to the chimney, dangling from Benji's bedroom window with the tenuity of a tree's last leaf, was a black shutter, the only one left on the house, its last touch of ornament. Benji returned to the clothesline with 3 spongy, muddy clothespins. With one, he pinned 5 washcloths, and with another, a bunch of cleaning rags, and with a third, he hung his mother's 2 white blouses together by the collars. The clothesline creaked, then sagged closer to the ground. He caught the pole just in time. He looked up to see Norm coming down the driveway. His eyes were red and puffy, and one side of his face was streaked with dirt.
"You little faggot," Norm growled. "Come here, you get in here."
"Norm, I can't, the..."
Benji was trying to explain as he braced up the clothesline, but Norm flung his glove at him and growled,
"I want to talk to you, now."
He stormed inside and slammed the door.
"He's mad at you,"
Louis whispered from the box. Just then the dog darted out and snagged Norm's big webbed, deeply oiled glove, then rolled on its back, whipping the glove from side to side.
"Louis,"
Benji called. With both hands supporting the line, there was nothing he could do.
"Get the glove."
But the dog was already on its feet and trotting toward the woods with Louis scrambling after him. At the edge of the yard, Louis froze.
"Get him!"
Benji called. But Louis wasn't allowed to leave the yard, so Benji let go of the sopping wet line, and before it had even hit the ground, he was running after the dog, calling to it, panting, begging it to stop, come back, drop the glove.
"Please, please, please,"
he cried as he ran. But the dog was gone. He had lost him. The dog, ears perked back, head slung low, ran with a mighty speed, disappearing into the woods, galloping some distance until it came to the rich ooze of the lower banks of Moon Brook, foul with runoff from the pig farm and the dump. Suddenly the dog stopped,
It sniffed the air, then turned and crept deep into a viney thicket. Here in the dark earthen coolness, it lay down panting, its drooling muzzle on the soft glove while it watched the man's quiet, quiet body. Benji was confused. Norm acted as if the drunken scene outside school yesterday had been all Benji's fault. Norm said he should have gone the other way the minute he saw him. Benji said that he had tried to. Then he shouldn't have talked to the asshole. Benji said that he hadn't, really.
But you were there, Norm exploded. Don't you see? Don't you get it?
He didn't, and yet he did. Somehow he was culpable. Everyone was. Everyone but his father, whose condition, whose very nature, absolved him of responsibility. They were eating dinner now, and every time Norm looked at him, he felt sick inside. He'd really hate him when he found out about his glove, Benji thought. Alice asked where the salesman had gone, but their mother interrupted to ask Norm about the street department job interview with Jardine Green. Norm said he hadn't made it to town hall today. She put down her fork and for a moment seemed to be smiling. Relieved, Benji smiled too.
What? What do you mean you didn't make it? You didn't feel like it? You didn't have time?
She kept hitting the table.
Or maybe you've got something better. Is that it?
I got held up, Norm said. But I'm going tomorrow, I promise.
Right after school, she said, seeming disarmed by his earnest gaze.
Right after school, Norm said.
You damn well better, she warned.
I said I would, Norm said softly.
He smiled.
And I will.
Make sure you do, she said, her chin out.
Benji was shocked. The big game was tomorrow, but he didn't dare remind Norm for fear he'd ask about the glove.
Where's that Mr. Duval?
Alice asked again, her cheeks red and irritated looking. Her lips were chapped and her eyes were bright and her blouse was inside out.
I have no idea, their mother sighed, looking toward the back door.
Probably got his car back and now he's on his way.
Weird guy.
Alice sighed with a distant little smile as she pushed food around her plate.
A traveling salesman, can you imagine?
Marie looked quickly at Alice, her eyes narrowing.
Where'd you go after school?
Oh, Alice shrugged. Around, you know, stopped in to see Mrs. Stoner. And I was looking for a job, of course, before I saw Mrs. Stoner.
Where'd you go? What places?
Marie interrupted. Benji and Norm watched their mother lay the trap. They watched Alice stumble toward it.
Some stores?
What stores?
The tailor shop and then Pilgrim's, she shrugged.
With your blouse inside out,
Marie said, the words forced through lips of wire. Alice's hand flew across her chest.
Oh, no,
she said, her face reddening as she looked up at them.
It must have been like this all day. Ever since this morning.
Marie got up and picked up her plate.
No, it hasn't, she said, staring down at Alice. When you left, it was on right.
After dinner, Norm said he'd be in his room studying for the two finals he had tomorrow, and then he'd be going to bed. The radio played loudly in his room, and Marie called up twice for him to turn it down. Alice was taking a bath. The sweet steam of soap, shampoo, and talcum powder seeped under the bathroom door. Benji didn't know why wearing a shirt inside out was so bad, but Alice and his mother still weren't speaking. His mother had set up the ironing board in the kitchen doorway so she could see the television. Benji watched from the couch. Milton Berle was under a sheet on an operating table. Every time the doctors and nurses touched him, he giggled. His mother laughed, and Benji smiled. Though he didn't think Milton Berle was very funny, he loved watching this show with his mother because it made her so happy. She held up Norm's ironed shirt and put it on a hanger. She paused now as Milton Berle ran around the operating room in his hospital Johnny with the doctors and nurses chasing him. Suddenly, Norm's radio blared so loudly that they couldn't hear the show. Marie sent Benji upstairs to tell Norm to turn it down. When he opened the door, the lights were on, and the bed was covered with textbooks and folders and papers. But Norm was gone. The window was open.
Benji turned down the radio and hurried back downstairs.
Is he still studying?
His mother asked.
I guess so. I don't know how he can think with all that racket, she said, as she unrolled a wet towel on the arm of the couch. She shook out another damp, starched shirt.
The iron hissed as she pressed it into the collar. Benji squirmed, wishing he'd turned the radio off. What if it got loud again and she went up herself?
God, he's funny, she said, shaking her head as a new skit began.
Milton Berle wore a wig and a dress as he battered a policeman with a purse. The audience screeched with laughter. Leaning over the ironing board, Benji's mother hugged herself and laughed until there were tears in her eyes. He smiled uneasily.
Be careful,
he was thinking.
Be careful.
He's so funny,
she gasped. Outside, a car had just pulled into the driveway. Klubach's dog was barking. The rap on the door was hard and curt. His mother opened the front door, which was beside the television, so in an odd way it seemed to Benji that he was watching two screens, two shows. There was a Pepsodent ad now on one screen with a toothbrush dancing around a tube of toothpaste, while in the other stood Billy Hendricks with head bowed and a swollen lip he kept touching. Beside him was Mr. Hendricks, who still wore his mailman's uniform. Oh, Marie said, stepping directly in front of them, making it clear they couldn't come in. It's you, Eddie. The light's broken.
We just came from the dentist, Marie. Billy here's got to have a new cap made. And I know times are tough right now, but it seems to me fair's fair, which is how I brung my boys up. So your Norm's the one ought to be responsible now, Marie, because a lesson lived is a lesson learned, I always say. And believe me, I know how hard it is for...
Eddie, what are you talking about? She finally broke in.
His cap,
Mr. Hendricks said, nudging his son. He was nervous.
Show her. Show her.
Mr. Hendricks ordered until Billy opened his mouth, revealing the black gap of a missing front tooth. Just then, Alice came out of the bathroom in her old red chenille bathrobe with its raised white roses on the pockets. Her wet hair dripped onto her shoulders.
Oh,
she said when she saw Billy, his lip being stretched up now by his father, who was pointing at the damage and explaining that Dr. Yale had promised a rush job so it would look all right for graduation.
Oh,
Billy groaned, pushing his father's hand.
Oh, hi,
Alice muttered, turning her head. Looking just as miserable, Billy muttered,
hi.
She ran so fast up the stairs that she tripped on her bathrobe and fell forward. Benji stared down at the floor.
Norm?
Marie called.
Get Norm,
she said through clenched teeth. He closed his eyes on his way upstairs, praying, hoping that Norm had climbed back in through the window.
Bastard,
his mother groaned, flying past him into the room.
Where is he? Where the hell is he?
She cried, turning in a bewildered little circle. She ran to the window and looked out. And then she locked it.
He'll pay,
she cried, kneeling by Norm's bed and reaching under the mattress.
Damn right he'll pay,
she said, pulling out Norm's $31. Benji couldn't believe she'd do that. That money was for the used car Norm wanted. For the past year, he had saved every penny that came his way. At 10 o'clock, Norm still wasn't home. Marie sat on the couch, staring at the door, waiting. Alice lay in bed. She saw the lights go out in the Klubach's upstairs windows, and she stroked her thigh, imagining Mrs. Klubach in a sheer nylon gown opening her soft arms to Mr. Klubach. In his room, Benji heard the first clink, 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 from the backyard, then louder and more insistent, clink, clink, clink. He crept to the foot of his bed, and with his cheek against the cool wood of the window frame, he could see the tall, white-suited form of Omar Duval, bracing the clothesline while he pounded the metal pole into the wet night earth with a rock down deeper and deeper. At 10 o'clock, Weeb Miller peeled his father's white and coral Pontiac out of the weedy gully where they'd spent the last hour drinking and waiting for Parker's. They threw their empty cans out the window, and Norm unwrapped three sticks of gum for himself, Weeb and Tommy Mullins, who sat in back, his huge arms hanging over the front seat between Weeb and Norm.
"Sit back," Weeb hollered. "For Christ's sake, all I can see in the mirror is your fat face, Mullins."
Tommy laughed. Instead of sitting back, he lowered his head, digging his chin into the top of the seat.
"That's no good,"
Weeb groaned, and so Tommy laid the side of his head on the back of the seat. Norm laughed. Mullins was a hopeless creep, but his father owned the bakery, and he always had money. When they couldn't get beer out of Weeb's father's refrigerator in the garage, they always picked up Mullins to buy it for them from Mrs. Carper up in the flats.
"So what do you think, Norm?"
Weeb said, once again bringing up tomorrow's game.
"It's worth a try, anyway."
All night long, Weeb had been after him to have his mother's boss, Ferdinand Briscoe, call Coach Graber, like he had the last time Norm got in trouble for fighting.
"At least ask him,"
Weeb said, his voice getting whiny.
"Graber'd eat shit if Briscoe said to."
Mr. Briscoe supplied St. Mary's with free baseball uniforms.
"Hey," Norm laughed, "I just don't give a shit."
And right now, he didn't, not after six beers. Plus, he'd rather miss the game than have his mother find out he'd been kicked off the team again.
"You give a shit," Tommy Mullins said. "Course you give a shit."
They both looked back at him. This was none of Mullins's business. Mullins shook a cigarette from his pack and offered it to Norm, who was about to say he was in training. Instead, he lit it with a deep, satisfying drag. Norm turned up the radio. Ricky Nelson was singing "It's Late." Weeb reached under the seat for his drumsticks, which he beat on the wheel, dashboard, and windshield as he drove. Tommy sang loudly. He knew the words to every song, and he had a loud, catchy voice Norm envied. Norm put his head back with his eyes closed while he smoked. He was thinking of Alice with her blouse inside out and the horrible look on her face as their mother bore down on her. Jesus Christ, sometimes he thought they were all nuts. Sometimes all he wanted was to get as far away as he could from this whole fucking disaster his life was turning into. He thought of Billy Hendricks's startled, flattened face, and he turned toward the open window and couldn't help smiling. When they got to the Four Clover bowling lanes, Weeb's father's team was still bowling, so they headed in to watch. Norm caught their reflection in the plate glass window. Their walk was the same, thumbs tucked into their side pockets, and on their faces a scowl that was supposed to be menacing, but instead came off looking peevish. He saw his Uncle Reenie bowling inside. He was afraid his uncle might say something about the job interview at Town Hall. If he did get the job, he didn't want everyone knowing it had been with the help of a creep like Reenie LaChance. He hung back in the doorway and watched Uncle Reenie's short, thick body approach the lane. Nervously, Reenie kept wiping his hand on the sides of his pants. Then he wiped his brow and, taking the ball, went into a frantic running delivery that wobbled the ball along the edge of the lane, missing every pin. Someone laughed. "Asshole," Norm thought as his uncle tried again, rolling the ball into an erratic spin that sank into the gutter halfway down the lane. Reenie wiped his hands on his pants as he hurried back to his seat. When he sat down, none of the men spoke to him. Reenie smiled happily, watching each man get up, and when his team did well, he shook his fist in the air and hollered to no one in particular. While Weeb and Tommy stood behind Mr. Miller's team, Norm waited by the desk, watching Bernadette Mansaw up on her platform, where she gave out shoes and, when they were returned, sterilized and buffed them. Bernadette was the same age as Alice, but here under the fluorescent light she looked older, her flesh faintly lined in purple creases. Her eyelids were painted deep blue, and her full mouth was a slick red. She sat on a stool smoking. She yawned and smiled at Norm, then watched the shoes pass slowly by on the conveyor belt that fed them through the sterilizing ultraviolet rays of the glass box. Every time the light in the box flashed on, it outlined the long sling of her heavy breasts in her thin white sweater that was buttoned down the back.
"Late night sucks," she said, yawning again.
Norm glanced back, then realized she was talking to him. To him! The ball rolled down the alley. The pins rattled and fell with a roar from the crowd. Bernadette sighed.
"I'm glad someone's happy. I missed my ride, and Now I got a walk home, and I got my groceries.
She nodded at the two full bags on the floor. She looked at Norm.
You waiting for somebody?
He nodded, still chewing his gum.
Who you waiting for?
My friend Weeb. Well, his father. Weeb's waiting, too.
Oh.
She looked disappointed. Her gaze fell dully back to the glass box. She passed another pair of shoes through, then with a chamois dipped in cream buffed their heels and toes.
The thought of walking all that way kills me, she sighed.
Norm looked back at the lanes. With all the beer and now this glare and racket, his head was starting to spin.
They're almost done, she said, picking up another pair of shoes. Hey, what's your name? Oh, yeah, she said when he told her. You're Alice Vermoyle's brother.
She ground out her cigarette in a large ashtray loaded with red-ringed butts.
I was in school with Alice all the way to freshman year. After that, I kind of quit on school. Couldn't take the nuns.
She lit another cigarette.
I could never figure them out. I mean, never getting married or having kids or having a good time. But Jesus Christ, let me tell you, they got the life.
She laughed.
The voice of experience. That's two kids later talking.
The men were coming out of the alleys, jabbing each other's arms and wiping their faces with towels. After them came Tommy and Weeb, who carried his father's duffel bag. Mr. Miller was a serious, red-faced man who always looked worried. He had a government job, the nature of which Weeb had only recently confided to Norm. Mr. Miller was a venereal disease specialist with the state health department. Weeb said his father was afraid people might take it the wrong way. Weeb said it was mostly the kidding his father couldn't take. He said his father hated kidding, hated fooling around, especially about sex.
See you next week, doll. Take it easy, sweet lips. Don't do anything I wouldn't do, unless I'm there.
The men called out to Bernadette, in spite of the fact that most of them had children her age.
Yeah. Hey, sure. You can bet on it. Hey, Harry. Up yours.
She laughed, then whooped as Harry Temple vaulted the counter and bent her back in a swooning embrace. As she giggled and struggled to get free, Norm watched those thick, fleshy breasts drag over Mr. Temple's arm. He followed Mr. Miller, Weeb, and Tommy outside.
Hey, he heard his uncle call. Norm! Hey, that's my nephew there. Quite a baseball player, that one.
Norm,
Mr. Miller said, getting into the car. Norm was already in back with Tommy.
That's your uncle calling.
Norm waved as Weeb pulled out.
Reenie's an alternate, Mr. Miller said. Somebody couldn't come.
They drove with all the windows open to flush out the smell of beer. Weeb told his father they were going back to Norm's house and try to cram one more history chapter in before tomorrow's final.
Good luck, man,
Mr. Miller said, giving them the thumbs-up sign as he got out of the car. With his long, straight stride up the moonlit path to his front door, he looked like the officer he'd been in the war. Weeb said his father had a scar from his groin to his neck that was purple and lumpy and throbbed in cold weather. Norm had told Weeb that his father had been wounded in the war, too. But then, when Weeb didn't ask him about it, he felt like an asshole for lying. As soon as Mr. Miller was in the house, they burst out laughing and turned on the radio as loud as it would go. Fats Domino was singing Blueberry Hill, and with Weeb wrapping his sticks all over the inside of the car and Mullins singing, they headed back toward West Street, along the route Norm said Bernadette Mansall would be taking.
What'd she say? Mullins asked. It's not what she said, Norm said, his heart a strange pinching beat in his chest. It's what she wants.
He scanned the sidewalks ahead.
What she want?
Weeb asked, his voice pitching recklessly high the way it did whenever girls or sex was the subject.
Me?
Norm laughed.
She fucking wants me. She's fucking married, Mullins gasped. She's not fucking married, Weeb said. Well, she's got two fucking kids, Mullins said. So? Norm laughed. And her boyfriend's a fucking convict. He's in fucking jail, Mullins said. And his fucking brother's Blue fucking Mooney. Holy shit, that's right, Weeb said, turning down the radio. Norm, I don't want to...
There she is, Norm yelled. There she fucking is!
Ahead, teetering along the dark sidewalk on stiletto heels, her beehive hair swaying, her small round hips churning, her arms hugging two grocery bags, was Bernadette Mansaw, 17-year-old legend.
Slow down! Slow down!
Norm cried with a jab in Weeb's ribs that made him yelp.
Want a ride?
He called out the window.
Oh, shit! Do I ever! Am I happy to see you?
Bernadette groaned. Norm made a squealing noise, and in the back seat, Tommy Mullins giggled as Bernadette climbed eagerly into the front between Norm and Weeb. She smelled of leather and shoe polish. Norm put his arm over the back of the seat, his fist nudging Weeb, who stared over the wheel, his mouth fixed in a foolish smile as they cruised along. Bernadette lived across from the post office above a fruit and vegetable store. To get to her apartment, she had to go down the alley and then climb an exterior flight of wooden stairs.
I can get him. I got him, she said, backing out of the car with her groceries.
No, sir, Norm insisted. Those are too heavy. You'll hurt yourself.
You might get a hernia,
Weeb called out the window.
Let Norm carry him.
Yeah,
Mullins chimed in.
Old Norm will be glad to.
Her apartment was at the end of a damp black corridor lined with boxes and fruity-smelling crates.
So you got kids,
Norm said as she unlocked the door. She turned on the light. Her apartment was small and surprisingly neat. The stove and refrigerator were on the wall opposite a red couch that was already pulled out and made up into a bed with sheets and a spread.
Yeah, I got kids, all right, she sighed. Two, Mary and Noel. They're both Christmas babies.
She took the bags from him and set them on the table. He wasn't sure what to do next.
Well,
he said somberly,
it was nice, carrying your bags. Guess I better go.
She was taking cans and boxes out of the bags.
Hey, want a drink or something?
She looked in one of the bags.
This week I got root beer. It was on special.
She dropped ice cubes into a glass and poured in root beer. After she gave it to him, she kicked off her shoes and reached back to undo the top two buttons of her sweater, then continued to unload her groceries.
Good root beer,
he said, wiping froth from his mouth. She was so short he looked down on the crown of her head.
If you want some more, help yourself.
With trembling hands, he poured more into the glass. He went to drink, and his teeth clinked against the rim. He wondered if she'd charge him anything. He'd heard the guys she liked were free. He stayed close by the table where she was checking the register slip against the items she'd unpacked. He thought of his $31. No. No, he wanted his car too much. Maybe she'd let him pay a little at a time.
Hey, Norm.
She looked up from the slip.
Yeah?
He winced, knowing he'd sounded too eager.
What's 3 for $89 if you only get one?
One what?
His voice cracked in his dry, tight throat.
Tomato juice.
30,
he said, his heart thudding with her approach. She handed him the register slip.
What's that one? 2 for $69 if I only got one.
20. I mean 35,
he said, staring down at the beads of sweat on the back of her neck.
Well, thanks, she said, looking up. Thanks a hell of a lot.
She patted her hair and groaned.
I was beat, let me tell you. Lately, I've been working my tail off, and I'm just beat all the time.
She grinned.
You waiting for something? A tip or something?
She said, giggling.
Oh, no, I'm just leaving,
he said, his tongue growing heavy. I'm just going.
You're cute,
she said, pulling his head down as her mouth covered his.
Okay,
she murmured, holding his face in her hands, and he nodded. But it wasn't okay. He wanted more. This time, he kissed her, running his hands up and down her back, squirming against her, moaning, his eyes closed so that he never saw the door swing open. Blue Mooney stood in the unlit doorway, in his black pants, black t-shirt, black boots. Only his yellow hair and pale flesh gave any light through the darkness. In each arm he carried a sleepy-eyed child.
The older girl, a redhead with pale blue eyes, leaned forward with her arms outstretched, crying, "Mommy! Mommy!"
"Your ma said their pants are..."
Mooney said, then peered closely.
"What the... who the hell's... Bertie!"
he bellowed as she shoved Norm away. Just then, from the hallway came a roar as a stack of empty orange crates crashed to the floor. In one motion, Mooney set both children down and darted into the hallway, then returned a second later, clutching Weeb and Mullins. He shoved them at Norm, and they staggered into one another.
"Son of a bitch!"
Mooney snarled, his square jaw set, his sharp lower teeth exposed.
"You ever come up here again, I'll break your fucking legs, and then I'll break your fucking arms!"
They were running out the door and down the creaking wooden stairs, and they could still hear his voice.
"And then I'll break your fucking back, and then I'll break your..."
Benji dreamed. He dreamed clear dreams of such detail that they seemed more real than life itself. He dreamed that the man in the white suit was still outside, hammering and sawing, raising the rotted fence posts and laying on the rails, and tearing out the rooted vines and weedy trees with his bare hands, and every now and then his sighs stirred the night like a breeze through the leaves and curtains. He did not stop. In the cool night dirt, he dug and he raked, and he dug and he raked, his soft leather shoe working the shovel like a spotless gloved hand, digging and raking all night long, smoothing, sculpting the yard to the symmetry of a garden in bloom, fragrant and densely green with broad dark leaves that curled and swayed like fans, and tiny blossoms and bluebell-like flowers that bobbed, and through the tender white roots worms burrowed, and a hard, cold snail inched its way up each stem and down each leaf. Its shell was white in the moonlight, and its probing eyes at the end of the soft gray feelers were as blue as the morning sky. Benji's eyes opened wide. Doors were slamming, windows were closing. Norm was home.
"That's my money!" Norm bellowed. "You can't do that! You can't just take my money! No, not me, but you and your goddamn bull-headed temper, that's what took your money. And for sneaking out of the house, you can't go out for 2 weeks!" "2 weeks!"
Norm cried.
2 weeks, mister, and I don't want to hear another word!"
she shouted. When she had gone to bed, he could hear Norm sobbing in his room, and Benji realized that it wasn't just the money, but his glove. That must be where he'd gone tonight. Benji felt terrible. Norm had been out all this time trying to find his glove for tomorrow's game. No one was speaking. Benji and Norm were eating breakfast when the back door creaked open.
"Good morning, folks,"
Omar Duval called heartily.
"And oh, what a beautiful morning it is."
He had a stubble of whiskers, and his suit was soiled and frayed. In the true north light, he seemed much older. Wrinkles outlined his eyes, and his hair looked white at the roots, silvery white, as if in a night he had lived 20 years.
"I got just so far,"
Omar was telling Benji's mother, who had hurried into the kitchen at the sound of his voice.
"And it was dark, and this terrible feeling came over me."
His voice lowered.
"I felt like I couldn't breathe, like if I took one more step."
He sighed.
"One more, and I would surely die."
"You were probably exhausted," she said nervously. "All the commotion you've been through."
"I have passed through a torrent, through a water unsupportable,"
Duval drawled in a strange monotone. He stared at her.
"And the snare. The snare is broken."
The two brothers looked at each other.
"Holy shit,"
Norm said under his breath. Benji couldn't tell if his mother was clearing her throat or laughing nervously, or both. "There's more toast," she said. "And there's coffee. Would you like some?"
"Oh, this is wonderful,"
Duval cried, already chewing.
"This is truly wonderful."
"It's just regular bread," she said.
"I mean just being alive."
With his rising voice, the very air seemed to darken and swell, the way air does before a storm.
"And being here with all of you."
The woman lived in her dining room in an enormous crib with hinged, slatted sides. This was Bridget Vermoyle. At the foot of the crib, there was a massive buffet that had once contained platters and linens and silver, and now was stocked with huge diapers, baby oil, cotton balls, and her pastel bed jackets. A large mahogany mirror hung over the buffet. Once again, Bridget had no choice but to watch the old woman in that mirror. So homely, she thought. The old woman in the mirror had no teeth, and her skin craped in dry folds over sharp bones and blue veins. Bridget watched her daughter, Helen, feeding the old woman mush on a spoon. Helen patted the dribbles that leaked down the woman's chin. Helen and the house girl, Josie Amenka, used to set the old woman on a bedpan. But a few years ago, they had fractured her shoulder lifting her, so now they pinned big diapers around her skeletal hips. Since then, Bridget had been spared the horrible sight of the old woman perched atop the bedpan, blinking and grunting, her wizened face reddening like a child's as she strained. Today was a better day. Today she could see better. The vapors were gone. Today the voices were clear, not staticky and run together. But the words still confused her. She recognized them, but could not always recall their meanings. It was the same with faces. Like this grim-eyed daughter spooning mush into the mirror. What was her name? Bridget watched the old woman clamp her mouth shut to the raised spoon. Open, her daughter said wearily. The old woman in the mirror pointed at Bridget's daughter.
Sam,
the old woman said, then gulped as the spoon spilled into her mouth.
No, Bridget thought. Not Sam. Not Sam. Don't say that. She gets mad.
And sure enough, her daughter's head drew back with a sigh of disgust. Helen, mother. It's Helen, your daughter, who feeds you and washes you and changes your diapers. As she spoke, she shaved mush from the old woman's chin with the edge of the spoon. It's Helen, who cooks and slaves for a husband who brings home a handful of change from his store and dares tell me they're the week's receipts. It's Helen, who hides her drunken brother's bottles and cleans up his vomit, and can't hold her head up in public, and...
Sammy?
The old woman in the mirror said hopefully, raising a hand to the daughters. Helen's eyes closed.
Oh, mother, she sighed. Why did you do this to me? I'm so sick of it. And now, with the judge dead, it's all up to me.
Bridget watched her daughter take the old woman's bony hand and hold it against her cheek.
All I'm trying to do is what you wanted, mother. But I'm so tired.
Bridget picked up her sock doll and hummed softly. She was tired of the old woman and her bitter daughter, whose voice grew garbled and staticky. She hugged her doll and looked out the window at the locust tree. When Sam was little, he used to climb to the top of that tree. Sometimes, when everything was just exactly right, she could see him there still. Well, here it was noon, with the gentlest of June breezes like fingers up and down his shirt back. Noon, and for 24 hours, Omar Duval had been free of them. Free! He felt so free he actually had to take deep breaths just to weight his feet to the pavement. So free, he was thinking now, he probably shouldn't have told that woman and her children his name. He should have taken a new one, a name like Bart Trudell. Trudell had been his mother's name, a good, honest American name, the kind of name for the kind of man who'd make this country great. Ahead on the sidewalk was a young red-haired woman in a peach dress. She swung a bowling bag as she walked toward him. He smiled, and she smiled back. He winked and saw the blood rise in her freckled cheeks. Yes, he thought, continuing along. He was that kind of man, the kind who could sell toothpicks one day and combustion engines the next, the kind of man for whom the marketplace was America's last frontier, a virgin vastness of such hope and possibility that for a moment now his eyes blurred with tears as he stared at the street sign. Now that meant something. Main Street, the very heart of America. He looked at the park across the street with its tall elms and its white globe gas lamps and its lovely round bandstand. What he did not notice were the rutted tracks scarred through the grass, because he turned suddenly when he saw the hand-lettered cardboard sign tacked to the porch rail of the old brown house. Room to let. He hurried across the street. He didn't even see May Mayo, still as a bird in the dusty porch shadows, until he was on the top step. "Hello," she whispered, the blue wash of her hair pale as her eyes. She twisted a hanky in her lap, weaving it tightly between her fingers.
"I thought we had another hour," she said, mistaking him for one of the mounts from the funeral home. She started to get up. "I'll get Claire."
"How much is the room?"
he asked, motioning her back into the rocker.
10 a week, she said so softly he could barely hear her. 15 with board.
"I'm a clean living man," he said, squatting next to her, and tall as he was, she had to look down into his eyes. "A man of religion."
And seeing the flinch in her gaze, he explained,
"That is to say, of faith in my fellow man. Because of my lifetime of diplomatic assignments, I have been everywhere, lived everywhere, seen so much hoopla and exotica that all I want now's a quiet little room on a quiet street in a quiet town, far, far from the dangers of communism," he said, laying the $10 bill in her hand. "I have family in town, distant family that's begging me to move in, and so as not to affront their generosity completely, I will be taking meals at their table. Thank you," he said, rising now and taking her hand in his. "Thank you, kind lady." After school, Benji headed down the hill on the way to the store where his mother worked. She had errands for him to run. Like the streets downtown, Briscoe's Sporting Goods was empty. Benji came through the vacant aisles, his footsteps the only sounds in the store. With his hands jammed into his pockets, he glanced up at the second level to the glassed-in walls of Mr. Briscoe's office. He was surprised to see mirrors in place of the glass. Now it would be so much easier, he thought. Before, when he had taken things, it had always been from the warehouse, never from the store. Ahead on the right aisle was the baseball display. If no one was around, he could get a glove for Norm. But he didn't dare. Mr. Briscoe might be down any one of these aisles, and besides, taking something from the store really would be stealing. Tennis balls and badminton birdies and fishing flies from the boxes out back were one thing, but a catcher's mitt right off the counter with a price tag? No, that was too expensive, too planned. He put it back on the counter. He continued to the back of the store, through the warehouse, toward his mother's office, a windowless cubicle she shared with Astrid, the part-time bookkeeper. Astrid's slurpy voice and the steady tap of a typewriter filled the dim warehouse like gray rain. Directly under Mr. Briscoe's office, he paused. The windows on this side had also been replaced with mirrors. He looked around at all the cartons and wooden crates. One entire wall was lined with bicycle boxes. He proceeded slowly, hands clenched in his pockets, eyes scanning labels on the stacked boxes. His last time in here, he'd gotten Norm a jar of cream to rub on his glove. While Norm professed dismay with his thievery, he always kept what Benji brought him. It had come to be their punishment for Briscoe's underpaying their mother. Whenever there were loose tennis balls, he always took a couple for Klubach's dog.
"It was just 3 couples, Astrid was saying.
His mother's office had no ceiling, only walls and a frosted glass door. He knew his mother must be glad Mr. Briscoe couldn't look down into the office anymore. As much as she admired Mr. Briscoe's keen business sense, she thought he was too nosy.
"Some people from the wire plant," Astrid continued.
His mother's typewriter never stopped.
"Well, to hear him, you'd think I'd invited the whole town."
The phone rang once. The typing stopped, and his mother's musical store voice answered. "Briscoe's Sporting Goods? Yes, we carry them, but Jake's not on the floor right now." "That's right. He's at the judge's funeral. Call back around 4. His mother resumed typing.
"I think we drank maybe 3 six-packs total. Astrid sighed.
The thing is, because he's older, he thinks I'm always comparing him to younger guys.
There was a pause, and then she giggled.
And I keep telling him, no, Bobby, it's you I want, you and all your money.
The typing continued. His mother never said a word. Astrid better watch it, he thought, as he opened the door. Astrid grinned at him.
Hey, look who's here, she laughed. My favorite boyfriend.
She winked, snapping her gum as her fingers darted over the adding machine buttons. A long roll of paper unfurled to the floor. Astrid was small, a woman's body at child's height. Her harlequin glasses flashed with rhinestone chips. Her teased and sprayed hair seemed an areola of spun glass. Her skin was lovely, so clear, so moist it glistened. He loved looking at her. Certainly she was the most exotic woman he had ever known. She had started working here last fall. His mother said she wouldn't last very long, that she was out of her element in this dull little town, a Las Vegas showgirl married to a homely insurance man old enough to be her father. "Just a minute, Benji," his mother said. Here she acted different. She never swore or banged things in anger. Like the pleasant voice that had just answered the phone, this smile was seen only here, set with a calmness that looked almost painful. Only her eyes betrayed her. Boiling and quick, they probed him like fingers. Compared with Astrid, his mother looked tired and plain. He waited by the desk while she finished typing a letter.
She'll be right with you, honey. Your mom's a champ, a real champ. Of course, what she needs is a little fun.
Astrid gave a rueful laugh.
Don't we all? I mean, you'd think three couples was a mob or something.
It was a moment before he realized she was talking to his mother again. After each phrase, she slurped saliva in through her teeth. In a picture she'd shown his mother, she was dressed in a skimpy black costume, spike heels, and a little white apron. It had been a year ago in Las Vegas that she met Bob Haddad one night and married him the next. Benji had seen them together recently, and he'd been shocked at how homely Haddad seemed, how dark and loutish next to Astrid's clear pink skin and silvery hair. She had a brand new convertible, and she wore outrageously glamorous clothes for a place like Atkinson. People said Bob Haddad was going crazy trying to please her. He'd bought her a new house and new furniture. Astrid claimed she did part-time bookkeeping here and at the wire plant just to keep busy and meet people. But his mother said the word around town was that Bob Haddad was deeply in debt. Benji knew a lot of odd facts like that about adults in town. Alice said it was because their mother had no friends, no one else to talk to but her children.
So, now he says no more parties. He says we got to get more serious about life. More serious? If he gets any more serious, I tell him, he'll be dead. You can't get more serious than dead, huh, kid?
She winked. Her fingers tapped, the rings sparkling as they flew.
Everything's such a goddamn calamity, you know?
When Marie finished typing, she opened her desk drawer and took out a paper bag. The broken washing machine dial was in it.
Like this thing in the park, Astrid continued. The blind man's popcorn stand. So what if it looks shitty? So what if it's gonna fall down? Who cares? Who the hell cares?
Bring it to Uncle Reenie, his mother was saying, so inured to Astrid's monologues that she hadn't bothered to apologize. Tell him if it's not one thing wrong, it's another, and I'm sick of it. Astrid glanced their way.
Yeah, and that goes ditto for me, too.
Remind him this is the eighth time in 2 years that washing machine's broken down on me.
Yeah, and don't take any crap from him either, kid.
Astrid grinned. Astrid, his mother said, her voice tight. Would you please shut up? He cringed, afraid his mother would start screaming the way she did at home.
I was trying to help, Astrid said. That's all.
Well, I wouldn't do this to you if you were in the middle of a conversation, his mother said.
Well, I wouldn't care if you did, Astrid said, pouting. I wouldn't get all worked up.
Her voice grew whiny and small.
I wouldn't say anything to hurt your feelings. You think you're the only one with problems. Well, you're not.
She stood up so suddenly that her chair flew back.
Other people have problems too, you know, she shouted, slamming the door behind her.
The cubicle's walls shook.
His mother had been staring down at the desk. She took a deep breath, then looked up, her eyes as flat as her voice. For a moment, he had a sense that, like him, she had another life, and this other life was a terrible burden sometimes. "You tell Uncle Reenie he either fixes the timer or gives me a new washing machine, okay?"
"Okay,"
he said, knowing he could never say any of it.
"Benji!"
she called when he was at the door.
"Yeah?"
He started back, his toes curled in his shoes. Was it the lost glove?
"Oh, nothing,"
she said, gesturing him off.
Just, if Mr. Duval comes to the house, would you call me?"
she said thinly, breathlessly, hopefully.
"I want to be sure I have food. If he comes, that is. I asked him, but he never really said."
He hurried through the warehouse to avoid Astrid, who must have run into the bathroom. The toilet kept flushing. He squinted now as he entered the store, blindingly bright with its fluorescent lights and shelves of colored boxes and glass cases of hunting knives and pistols. In the middle of the store, dangling by nylon wires from the ceiling, was an orange rubber life raft. As he passed underneath, it rocked gently as if on invisible waves. At the baseball display, he stopped. There, heaped on the counter, were baseball gloves of every size and shape, and right on the very edge was a soft, lustrous catcher's mitt, exactly like Norm's. Opening his book bag, he tapped the glove into it, then ran to the front of the store. He grinned as his hand closed on the cold brass handle.
"Hold it!"
a voice boomed from above, from everywhere.
"Hold it! Hold it right there!"
He turned. Overhead, a mirror slid open. Mr. Briscoe leaned out from the waist and pointed down at him.
"You wait right there, young man. Don't you dare move."
It took Mr. Briscoe a few minutes to get down into the store. He was a portly man, red-faced and always panting. By the time Mr. Briscoe reached him, Benji realized he should have put the glove back on the counter. But now it was too late. Mr. Briscoe had just retrieved it from his bag. He held it up and rocked back on his heels.
"You didn't have to do this, son. No boy ever has to steal from Briscoes, especially you, Benji. Why'd you do this?"
His eyes fixed in terror on the door into the warehouse. He expected to see his mother charge through it, her face white, eyes wide, her fists swinging.
"You want this glove?"
Mr. Briscoe asked, holding it out to him. He shook his head no. He could not speak. He could barely breathe.
"Take it,"
Mr. Briscoe said, jabbing the glove into his chest.
"It's yours. You can have it."
He shook his head, his hands heavy at his sides.
"Here,"
Mr. Briscoe insisted.
"Take it."
His face was getting redder.
"Don't you want it?"
All he wanted was to get out of here before his mother saw him.
"I'm sorry,"
he tried to say, but it wrung out of him like a whimper. Mr. Briscoe tossed the glove onto the counter and sighed.
"I know what it's like growing up in a house without a father. Things get all out of whack, don't they?"
He touched his breast pocket.
"You get this empty feeling. You want something, but you never know what."
His cheeks blistered with a fine sweat as he bent closer. Benji could almost taste the sweet cologne seeping from his pores.
"Isn't that right?"
He shrugged and nodded. He was losing track of Mr. Briscoe's meaning.
"You thought you wanted a baseball glove. Well, you didn't really, did you? You just wanted something. You weren't sure what, so you picked up the first thing you saw. And the whole time, all you really wanted was a friend, Benji. That's all,"
Mr. Briscoe said, his voice rising. He clapped his hands together and grinned.
"And by golly, Willikers, young man, you've got one now."
He extended his hand, and Benji was surprised at how hard and rough it was.
"Ferdinand T. Briscoe at your disposal,"
he said with a vigorous shake.
"Just name your pleasure, son."
Briscoe's gleaming gaze swept over the shelves and counters of merchandise.
"Baseball, badminton, golf, swimming or camping or backpacking or fishing." "Fishing,"
Briscoe cried.
"We'll go out in the boat."
Benji's eyes widened in horror on the swaying orange raft.
"That's what we'll do. The perfect sport. Ah, Benji, you'll love it. We'll go fishing, just the two of us. There's something about fishing, Benji. A man and a boy in the middle of a great body of water.
But I can't.
Of course you can. I'll speak to your mother. We'll go as soon as school's out.
No, I don't like boats.
Don't like boats?
Briscoe cried.
What kind of a boy doesn't like boats?
I can't swim.
To be in water over his head terrified him.
Can't swim?
Briscoe reached down to Muss's hair.
Well, you'll just have to learn how, then.
No, I can't, he said, shaking his head. I don't want to.
Briscoe looked at him.
I'll tell you what. You learn how to swim, and I won't tell your mother about you taking the glove.
He smiled and held out his hand.
How's that for a deal? Then, when you can swim, we'll go out in the boat.
As they shook hands, Benji felt sick to his stomach. Benji stood in front of Uncle Rini's appliance store. A bill head was taped to the door. It said, "Closed for funeral. Please come back at 5. I will be open an extra hour tonight to make up for any inconvenience. Sorry and thank you. Yours truly, Rini LeChance." With his cheek against the glass door, he peered into the long, narrow store. Uncle Rini's big yellow cat was asleep on top of a washing machine. He banged on the door, but the cat did not look up.
"Here, kitty, kitty, kitty,"
he called, and still the cat did not stir. From the corner of his eye, he saw the dark uniform.